Shalom, Havarim. Hello, friends. Glad you are here today on this daylight saving time day. I'll try to keep you awake today. Everybody awake? All right. I think there may be still some coffee left. If not, Gary finished. Okay. No, sorry. All right. Well, speaking of Roger cleaned it up. I'm sorry. Speaking of beverages, this week I was pouring myself a glass of milk. And when I finished pouring the glass, I set the milk on the counter and I kind of walked away. I was drinking my milk. You know, you're going to come back to it like a good old farm boy will. You want to keep the industry, you know, rolling. Anyways, I walk away from it and then I'm drinking my milk in another room and I hear something. I hear what sounds like a voice saying, "I'm hot. This food is icky. I want a pony." I'm like, what is that? So I go into the kitchen, because it sounds like it's coming from the kitchen, and I hear this voice again, and it says, "I'm hot. This food is icky. I want a pony." And I'm sure it's coming from this milk carton over here. So I go right to the milk, and I say, "Excuse me, what was that?" And the carton says to me, "I'm hot. This food is icky. I want a pony." Turns out, it was spoiled milk. I don't like whining. I don't like it when people whine. I get so disgusted sometimes with modern sports. I can't watch soccer, Major League Soccer, because all they do is whine. All they do is complain. Basketball is getting there as well. They just complain. Every single play, they complain. I can't stand whining in sports. I also don't like whining among adults. Like grown-up people that whine about the weather. It's too cold. It's too hot. You know, get a coat. Turn on the air conditioning. Do something about it. I get tired of people whining about young folks that don't wear their pants up where they're supposed to. It's true, they should pull up their pants, but you don't have to whine about it. It's not going to do anything. And I get tired of my kids whining. Am I the only one? Just my kids whining? No. The other day, I was told, and this is a direct quote, I was told, "You're the worst dad ever." You know from who. Why? Because I asked someone to pick up her socks. I don't like whining. So this week, being the wonderful father I am, I decided to employ a new tactic. Whenever someone would whine in my family, I would use the biblical approach. Which is to say, whenever someone whined, I would say, "What did God do whenever the Israelites whined?" The answer is, He sent snakes. Poisonous snakes, right? So next time you whine, I'm just going to remind you what happened. God sent snakes. All right, so I thought that was going to be a little funnier. All right. Now this is like, Kadrian, I saw some question in your eyes and in your reading and the inflection of your voice as you read this story. It's a strange story, isn't it? And when you go through seminary, they teach you some fancy terminology that helps you explain things like this. I'm going to teach you all a really helpful term. It's a highly theological term. It's technical jargon. And I want you to write this down because this will help us better understand this passage of Scripture. Whenever you read things like this chapter from Numbers, all you must do is simply say these words. That's weird. Can you say that with me? That's weird. I mean, is this not weird? This is a strange chapter. And you think about what we talked about last week. Last week we looked at the Ten Commandments. And one of those commandments was, have no images. Like, make no images. And then what happens in today's passage? God is saying, one book later in the Bible, make an image out of bronze. Make a snake. You know, God says, don't make any images of things above the earth, on the earth, below the earth. And now, a snake. And not just any animal. This is the very thing that the tempter took the form of in the book of Genesis. A snake. Put it on a stick. Look at it and you will be healed. What do you say about that? That's weird. So today I want to look at some weird things from this passage. I figure we have to keep it light to keep you engaged on a sleepy morning like this. We're going to look at some weird stuff. And these are the three weird things that I want to look at. The first is the weird food situation there among the Israelites. It gets even weirder when you read it in the original text. The second weird thing is simply asking the question, does the punishment fit the crime? And then the third weird thing is that whole idol thing. So we're going to look at these three weird things, and then I'm going to try to give you some practical teachings on this passage. And just know that that's not an easy thing to do. But here we don't try to back away from the difficult tasks of the church. What I'm going to do is try to look at these weird things, give you some things, some guides to make it a little more palatable. But ultimately, I'm not going to answer all your questions. I know that because I couldn't answer all of my questions. So what we're going to do is we're going to leave some room for mystery, which actually is something that I was taught in seminary and is a fancy way of saying that's weird. We're going to leave some room for mystery. But first, we're going to start by looking at that whole food situation. Whole food sounds like a fancy, hippie grocery store. The whole food situation. Nobody goes to Whole Food. Okay. So the first thing I want to talk about this morning is that whole food situation. And what first we need to notice where we're at in the whole story of the Exodus. We are about one generation removed from the Exodus out of Egypt. The people have been wandering in the wilderness for probably about 20 years. And this would have been normal in a male-oriented society where it was mostly male-dominated society, because they just wouldn't stop for directions. You know, they just keep wandering around, looking and looking. If the women were in charge, they would have found their way to the Promised Land in no time. Something like that. So they're wandering around the wilderness. They're looking for the Promised Land. Actually, it's a part of their punishment for being disobedient to God. Now think of the younger generation that are just coming up. They are now in leadership roles. They're probably in their early 20s. These are people that don't remember Egypt. They don't remember the food that they had in Egypt. All they've ever known is wandering. All they've ever known is the manna and the quail and occasionally the things that they would capture in the wilderness to eat. So obviously somebody is getting nostalgic. They're sitting there and they're thinking about the good old days. And they're thinking about, oh, when we lived in Egypt, we lived right along the Nile. And we could eat all the fish we could catch. And in some places it quotes them saying, oh, we had all the leeks we could eat. And you have to assume they had really bad breath if all they ate was fish and leeks. But sounds good? What? So they're leeky fish. I mean, that sounds weird. So they're reminiscing about all these things. And I just have to think, maybe, just maybe, they're looking in the past with some rose-colored glasses. Because if you remember, y'all were slaves in Egypt, right? They're reminiscing about those good old days. And here's what they say in verse 5. They, that's the Israelites, spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food. Okay, so this is the NIV, and the NIV is nice to these Israelites, because it's even worse if you read it in like the King James Version or some others that are more literal, because the word that is translated as bread and as food is actually the same word in Hebrew. It is lechem. Lechem is the same word that is used twice. So essentially the people are saying, there is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this terrible bread. Do you see some problems with that? Are they sounding more and more like children all the time? Yes, Dad, I'm hungry. Well, why didn't you eat the sandwich I made you? I detest this terrible bread, and there's no food in the house. You just didn't eat the sandwich. Yeah, they sound like whiny kids. And that's the first thing I just want to point out. Here they are, these people that have known nothing but wandering in the wilderness. Nothing but this bread, nothing but this quail. And God has delivered them out of captivity. And they're whining about it? Realize the blessings that God has given to you. Realize that God has delivered you out of something much worse. So that's the first weird thing about this passage, and it only gets weirder. The second one is simply to ask the question, does the punishment fit the crime? So let's remember here what happened. The Israelites complain about the food, and then says, then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. That's totally what you expect, right? That is normal. I mean, if you whine, you're going to get bit by a snake. I mean, learn your lesson, people. No, that doesn't seem consistent, does it? It doesn't seem like the punishment fits the crime. And the more we dig into this, the harder it is to realize, or the more easy it is to realize, this doesn't seem to make sense. Because in our Bibles, we have entire genres of literature that are just whines, just complaints. We call that the laments. And many of the psalms are psalms of laments, where people are complaining, God, where are you? God, why have you turned your back on us? God, why have you done this? Or why haven't you done that? And how many of those times does God send serpents to the people? It's, well, just this one. Yeah. You're talking about this one, right? Okay, I didn't miss one, right? Now, yes, there are other times when God punishes the people for complaining, but this seems extreme. So what I want to do is look at this a little bit, and I think I can make it a little more acceptable, but it's still kind of, it's weird. So when we look at this story, if you read it in the text, I'm going to bring that back up again. If you read this in context, notice that it never says that God sent these serpents in response to the people's complaining. There may be a certain cause and effect there that we assume, but neither the narrator nor God ever say God sent these serpents because, because the people were complaining. Now, it's clear that the Israelites assumed that was the cause, but never does anybody with any power or any insight say this is why it happened. Now, yeah, the Israelites assume that to be the case, but never is it told us if that is the case. And I think that if we read into the New Testament, Jesus kind of actually tries to speak into this a bit in an indirect way. And that's often the case. Jesus is correcting our theology. We read things in the Old Testament. People believe certain things. Jesus comes in and says, yeah, you're missing the point here. So, for instance, Jesus says this in Matthew 7, 11, 9 through 11. He says, which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks you for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? Are the people just doing that? They're just asking for a fish. They're asking for some sort of food. And which person of us, would anybody here, if your child asked you for another sandwich, would give him a snake? Just Cadron. But she's actually got snakes on hand at her house, so I don't know. So nobody would do that, no. And he's saying, of course, if you wouldn't do that, then why would God do that? And I think it applies in this case as well. The Israelites are complaining, yeah, but they're just asking for different food. Is God going to send a snake because they ask for different food? Maybe not. It doesn't seem to be the case. Now, it's true the text does tell us that God sent these poisonous snakes to the Israelites. I think that's one of the places where I just have to leave that there because I don't have the answer for that. Why did God send poisonous snakes to this community? But also we can ask other questions too, like why did God make mosquitoes? I don't know. And if you're going to tell me it's so that bats have something to eat, why did God make bats? I don't have the answers. We don't know. But I think it's a little bit of a step to say that God sent these snakes in response to the Israelites whining. All right, the third question, the strange thing that I want to address this morning, is that whole idol thing. Okay, this is one that's bothered me for a while. Now, you may remember that last week when we talked about the Ten Commandments, I said some people take those commandments a little further than I think is necessary. I specifically lifted up our brothers and sisters in the Amish church. Remember, the Amish people don't like to have their pictures taken because they believe that's an image. That is, then you're not supposed to have an image of human beings or anything on or above or below the earth. They don't put faces on their dolls, again, because you're not supposed to have engraven images. And I say, I don't think that's really the point of the text. And I would go so far as to say something like this. I'd say, well, okay, there's the text in question. The Lord said to Moses, make a snake and put it on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live. You know, we're never told to worship the snake, simply to look at it. You're never told to worship a doll. You can look at it. You're never told to worship a picture. Or you're never told to worship a picture. You can look at it. It's okay to look at things. You just aren't you're encouraged to not worship it. Some people will go so far as to say this. The prohibition is against worship anything that isn't God. It's not a question of whether or not you can make these images or have your picture taken. It's just make sure to don't worship things that aren't God. And again, I think that commandment from the Ten Commandments, it says, don't make anything of any images above, below, or on the earth, and don't worship them. It assumes that you're going to have some images there. The main thing is don't worship that which isn't God. And some people have even gone so far as to say this, the prohibition is against trying to make an image of God who is beyond our comprehension. So if you read again that whole story of the golden calf, when the Israelites are trying to come up with some sort of image of God. Moses is up on the mountain. When he comes down, Aaron has told the people, "This is Yahweh." Now, they didn't really think that that golden calf was Yahweh, the God who delivered them from evil. But they understood it to be an image of God. And God says, "No, don't make any images and try to capture me in an image, because I'm not a golden calf. I am beyond your understanding. I am the God who made the heavens and the earth." So the prohibition is against making the image of God, the God who made us all. So the people, they make this snake on a stick. A snake on a stick. It sounds like something you get at the fair, right? I'm going to go to the state fair this year. You get a fried donut, a fried Twinkie, and a snake on a stick. So they've got this snake on a pole. And you've got to think that God, whenever he commanded Moses to make this thing, God surely knew that the people are eventually going to worship it. And they do just that. We find several generations later, the king Hezekiah comes into power. And he's just cleaning the house. He's a devout man. And he's just like, "We're going to get rid of all these things, all these pagan things that are happening here in Israel. We're going to do away with that, and maybe God will bless our nation again." And we find this in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 4. He, that's Hezekiah, removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan, something like that. Nehushtan. God surely knew that the people would worship Nehushtan if he gave them the ability to look at it and they would be healed. So why did God make that thing in the first place? Well, I think we can extrapolate that and go to anything that God has done. Any miraculous thing that God has provided for the people. You think about the Ark of the Covenant. Here was this wonderful thing that God had given to the people, and they were to carry it with them from town to town, city to city. And if they took that to the city with them while they were in war, in battle, they would win. And there was a rule against touching that, right? If you touched the Ark of the Covenant, what would happen? You'd die. This is a thing full of power, full of authority. I would think that at some point people might worship the Ark of the Covenant rather than worshiping the giver of the covenant. And I think that modern Christians today, we have this same propensity to worship the things that God has given to us rather than worshiping the giver. I think that some Christians, they have a tendency to worship the cross. Or we look to the cross for salvation rather than looking to the one who died on the cross. I think that sometimes Christians look to the Bible and we worship the Bible rather than worshiping the one revealed in the Bible. Sometimes we look out in creation and we worship creation instead of worshiping the Creator. If we start asking questions, why did God give this thing, this miraculous healing through the snake? Why did God do this miracle for them if he knew that they may worship it? I think it's very clear to say that about anything that God has done. Why would God do that if he thought we would worship it? Well, if it's between God doing miracles or God not doing miracles, God saving us or God not saving us, I'm going to go for the miracle God and the saving God and try to avoid worshiping that which isn't God. So here's the situation, folks. There are some weird things going on in this text. And we have the extraordinary ability to worship things that are not God. But we are still called to have one God and put no God before that God. All right. So what do we do with the rest of this text? How do we make this practical for us today? Oh, look at the time. We should go, right? this one's a little bit more challenging because I've never been bitten by a snake. Anybody here ever been bitten by a poisonous snake? Not a poisonous snake? Okay. Is that a yes, you have? Not a poisonous snake. Okay, some of us have bitten by snakes, but nobody here has been bitten by a snake. We don't understand this. We can't really connect. So what do you do with this weird text? Well, I'm going to do something weird with this weird text. And I think it's okay because other people have done weird things with this text as well. What I'm going to do is kind of make it into an allegory. We're going to have an allegorical interpretation. And an allegory is simply when you take a story and you look at some of the underlying principles behind it and say, how does that adapt and work with our life today? Now, I think there's really good precedence for doing this because Jesus did it. So Jesus took this story, and when Nicodemus comes to him in the middle of the night, Nicodemus asks him all these questions, and Jesus tells him this: "Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes may have eternal life in him. This is not about snakes. This is not about being bitten and dying. This is about something else altogether. This is about salvation. This is about being forgiven. This is about being about grace. So Jesus uses this passage allegorically. And if Jesus can do it, I think we can too. All right, we're supposed to follow Jesus. We are his disciples. So the first thing I want to say about this text is that our choices have consequences. So I can't say for sure just what was going on in this situation. But what we know is that the people complained. God sent these serpents. The people were bitten. And then people died. So we know that the people then they go to Moses and they say, Moses, please pray to God to take away these serpents. And we don't have the exact words of Moses, but we assume that he prayed that prayer. It would make sense. God, take away these serpents. But God doesn't take away the serpents. People still get bit. Some people probably still die. God doesn't remove the problem, but he does give an alternative solution. He does provide an antidote. And I think if we take that and we allegorize it a bit, I think that we've all been bitten before, haven't we? We've all been hurt in some way. I know a couple of you raised your hands, you've been bitten by snakes, but we've been bitten by friends. We've been bitten by relatives. We've been bitten by people who we love, who we care about. And sometimes it's a direct response to the choices that we have made. And our choices, even if you are a Christian, you know, I'm all about grace. I love grace. Grace abounds. I'm very thankful for the grace of God. But even in a situation where grace does abound, we still make decisions that come back to bite us. If you decide, you know, hey, what is today? Today's the 11th of March. If you decide, I'm not going to go into work until, April, this, you know, I'm just going to stay home. I'm not going to call the boss. I'm not going to let them know what's going on. I'm just not going to go in for a few weeks. And you go in on April 2nd and you try to just pick up where you left off. There's a good chance that you won't have a job. And what are you going to do? You're going to say, but I'm a child of God. I'm a Christian. It's okay. Grace does abound. No, your choices still have consequences. Those snakes still bit people. They still got hurt. And if they refused to look at the snake that Moses made, they probably still died. So the first choice, or the first point I want to make is that our choices still have consequences. The second one I'm going to hold off to give my little synopsis of it until I kind of reset the stage here. So imagine that you are an Israelite and you're living during this time of wandering. People have complained, God has sent the snakes. You're living in a tent, and you know about these snakes. You probably have a friend or a family member who has been bitten by a snake and died. Maybe somebody really close in your family, your husband, your wife, even your child, has been bitten by a snake and died. Can you imagine living in a campsite, in a tent, knowing that your area is crawling with poisonous snakes? I mean, I don't like to camp as it is, because it's a little bit creepy. It's like, oh, there's a stink bug. No, their campsite wasn't crawling with stink bugs, crawling with snakes. Anytime you have to go to the bathroom, you probably would take a buddy with you. Anytime you want a moment of silence or quiet, you probably would still be looking over your shoulder every step of the way. I would think that the presence of these snakes would bother each and every person, each and every minute of the day. So rather than taking away these snakes, which the people surely feared, God told Moses, take something and make an image of a snake, and don't just leave it on the ground. Put it on a pole. Put it on a pole so people have to look that snake in the eye. Come eye to eye, nose to nose, with the very thing that they fear the most. There are times when we need to stare down our fears, to stare them down face to face, to stare them down eye to eye. And only in doing so can we overcome our deepest fears. I'm going to kind of go off the cuff here a bit because I had a couple different options that I was going to share, but we're going to just kind of roll with it here, and I'll try to get people out of here on time. I've shared a number of times kind of my background and my experience. I grew up in this rural community in Ohio, and there were times that I just didn't feel accepted, times I didn't feel loved, times I didn't feel appreciated, times I was just mocked by my community, my friends at school. I grew up without a lot of money, without a lot of things, didn't necessarily have the nicest clothes, didn't have the nicest home. And I was always the chubby kid. Didn't have the athleticism that many other people did, even my cousins, who shared a lot of the same genetic material as I did. I didn't have their giftings. I was always the slower, chubbier, poorer cousin. And I remember this because it still, I believe it still affects me to this day. And many times I want to be more. I want to be better than that. I want to be more than the slow, poor, chubby kid. I'm not asking for much, right? Don't be the poor. But yet I hesitate to share my aspirations because I think that people are going to look at me and like, it's Kevin. He's still that poor, slow, chubby kid. And in many ways, I am still poor, slow, and chubby. Hey, I actually weigh less than I did my senior year in high school. So, hey, take that. But I hesitate to tell people when I have goals because I'm afraid they're just going to sneer at me. You'll never do that. You'll never make it. And today I'm just going to stare one of those fears in the eye. Because for years I've been saying, one of these days I'm going to run the Park to Park half marathon. Do it. And for years I've trained and it doesn't come through. It doesn't work out for me. I don't follow through on it. Still that chubby, poor kid, Kevin, that doesn't have the athleticism to do those sort of things. I've done a number of races the last few years. Finished in the top 10 for my age group in a 6K, or what was it, 10K last fall. You can clap now. Beat all my friends at a 5K at the last turkey trot. Not to mention any names. Passed Tate Love going up the last hill. I felt pretty good about that one. Didn't say his name out loud. He couldn't be here for that today. No, finished very well in that. Knocked off of like 6 minutes from my previous best. Been training. I ran 26 miles last week in training. That in itself is a marathon. If I can do it all in one day, I've nailed it. I'm scared to tell you guys this because you're thinking, you're going to do a half marathon? I've got 6 weeks. Yeah, I'm going to do a half marathon. If my legs hold up, I'm going to do it. But this is a self-help kind of thing. I think it's more than that. Let's make it a Christian thing. It's not just about making yourself into a better person. How can we be better Christians, better followers of Christ? And I was going to tell a different story, but this morning I can change it up a bit because we've got this house over here. And a couple weeks ago, I talked about this refugee family, the family that Dwight has one of their children in school. And we heard about how they've come up from Miami after they lost some things there in the hurricane, and how maybe we could help them out as a church and let them use this house for a period of time and not charge them anything for that. And we as a church kind of got behind that. Things fell through. But you know what? The need rearose. It came back. And we're having these conversations as a church, and we're asking really good questions. We're asking, you know, what about this and what about that? What if they tear it up, or what if they abuse the privileges that we've given to them? And eventually, after we talk these things through, we're scared. We don't know what to do. We don't know what's going to happen. We have all sorts of questions. But we stared that snake in the face, the very thing that scared us. And last Friday, the family moved in. And I'm walking with the mother. And if you've been in this house, you know it's an old house. I remember, okay, AD, I remember what you said when we bought this house. You said, you know what this house really needs? You said, a match. This was before you painted it. And we put a lot of work into that house, and some people have been pretty rough on it. I'll admit that. It's been kind of rough. Garland redid the floors. They look wonderful. I'm taking this woman through, and there's the torn linoleum in the front, and it's kind of dirty. We've been using it for Sunday school. Kind of rough. And this woman, she's walking through the house, and she keeps saying, muy bonita. Muy bonita. Very pretty. Very pretty. She and her boys have been living at the mission. They've been living in their car. She said, muy bonita. Many of us wouldn't live in that house. Many of us look at that and say, yeah, it does need a match. The first thing she saw was the backyard, and she starts to cry. She gives me a hug. And she speaks very little English. She keeps saying, muy bonita, muy bonita. I'm still scared because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have all the answers. We continue to ask questions and we don't have answers. But we can be scared, or if we sense God calling us to do something, we look that snake in the face. And the only way to get through that, the only way to overcome your fear, is to stare it down face to face, eye to eye. My friends, Jesus is calling us to something muy bonita, something very beautiful. My prayer is that we will stare down the snakes, stare down the serpents, even the fiery serpents, the poisonous serpents that give us these fears, that keep us up at nights, whatever that may be, that we stare them down, for it is only in facing our fears that we may see the muy bonita life that God has called us to. I invite you to turn to the back of your bulletin. During Lent, we will be using this confession time, and we'll follow up the words of confession with words of grace and assurance. So I invite you to read with me the confession. We will pause, and then I'll lead you in the words of assurance. Together, God of compassion and consequence, some days it's hard to face who we are. We like to be in control, to know where we are going. Relying on someone else, even you, is hard. We get impatient and find things to criticize. Some of us even like to complain. Glossing over past hardships is easier than admitting that we need your help, and still do. We don't want to see how our attitudes and actions make things worse. We are sorry. Forgive our ingratitude. Grant us the courage to face the truth. Together, the words of assurance. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and He saved them from their distress. May it be so. Amen.